Okay, so we do that so we can just record this and not on my blah, blah, blah. Okay, so here's a question from Zach. Andrew, I understand that the pre-Buddhist Bun culture, religion of Tibet, had the foundation of dream yoga. Yes, it still does. Why do you think that other non-Buddhist schools, lineages have not developed the dream yoga? Well, they have. Let me tell you about them, particularly if you assume any of the practitioners are lucid at night. Yeah. Well, they have. Again, there's very, very little literature on these other traditions, but I get these most amazing correspondences from like my dear friend Yusuf Al-Hur, the Islamic scholar who I've interviewed twice on Edge of Mind. He reached out to me like 3 years ago with an amazing translation of a classic Islamic text on dream yoga, which had never been translated. So it's there. It's just not in the public domain. And also my friend Zvi Ish Shalom, the great Jewish mystic, love this guy, love them both. He wrote to me when we had some riffs on the side. He's a friend. We hang out now and again here. He tells me about Jewish Kabbalistic and post-Kabbalistic dream yoga. And the correlations are amazing. Same thing with the throat chakra. I mean, so many similarities. And so we can't assume that other traditions haven't developed the dream yoga. We may just not be aware of them, right? It's just the Tibetans, for, I don't know, one reason, I'm not sure why, they've just kind of taken hold of this. Also, like the Bardo teachings, those are two teachings that the Tibetans just seem to really run with. I can't speak at all about Christian mysticism. My guess is it's there as well. But the theistic traditions, it's very interesting to me, just a playful sidebar. The theistic traditions, no criticism. I'm not here to disparage other traditions. I was raised a good, solid Catholic. I'm still recovering. I say this tongue-in-cheek because I loved it. I was an altar boy. I played the organ. I loved it. I really did love it. I just didn't take it very seriously, I have to say. But I don't know of any Christian mystical approaches. But, you know, the whole theistic thing, this is just completely my rendering, is that, you know, they act kind of as the middleman, like the oil man, instead of going directly to solar power. And so I think some traditions, theistic traditions, may actually be intimidated by dream yoga, if it's even there. The Christian thing, I don't know. I should ask Father Francis Tiso. That's actually a good question. Note to self. He's the guy that I interviewed 2 years ago on Rainbow Body. I tell you, if this guy would have been my Catholic priest, I'd still be Catholic. He's amazing. But this is a great question for me to ask Dr. Francis Tiso. So note to self, I'm going to do it right now. Francis Tiso for dream yoga. So in short, it is out there. It's just that a lot of this has not been translated, and a lot of it is simply not in the public domain yet. So Francis Tiso on dream yoga. And then I will get back to you to see if Francis has anything to say about a dream yoga tradition. Okay. Oh, from my dear friend Barry. The other night I had the dream where I was chasing something and ended up on the bedroom floor with a broken collarbone. Yeah, bummer. I was there when you talked about that with Dr. Ed. Sorry about that, Barry. It seems like it was a broken REM experience. Yeah, out of phase REM sequence, REM sleep behavioral disorder. Could be. Like Dr. Ed said, difficult to say if you've just had one episode. I've never had anything like this before. Okay, and it seems that this could alter my relationship to dreams. If this is a chronic issue, with a broken collarbone, I won't be able to do any sleep studies for several months. I'm not entirely sure what you mean by sleep studies, Barry, so I'm not sure if that's important to your question, but if you want to come on and say something, that's fine. This is great for slowing things down, but also concerning. Any suggestions on how I can go forth with a lucid dreaming practice when I've had such an experience? Yeah, I wouldn't let just one experience completely derail your nocturnal experience. And especially with lucid dreaming practice, you can still work with lucid dreaming principles, even if you have some of these parasomnias. Lucidity cultivates awareness and whatever awareness you can bring to your dreams. I mean, how often is awareness damaging? Like, never. It may be damaging to your ego, but awareness is about the most fundamentally curative panacea that I know of. I can't think of anything that suffers with awareness. If there's someone out here who can come up with something, let me know. Ego will suffer. Ignorance will suffer. But outside of that, it's about the single most curative agent in the business. Is once enough to assume this is a permanent condition? Definitely not. Or should I see if I can experience something similar again under much safer conditions? Really? Yeah, I would recommend the latter. And I think like Dr. Ed said, I thought he was spot on with his comments yesterday. By the way, those of you who weren't there, I don't know how many 50, 60 sessions I've done with Dr. Ed ever since we started. Yesterday's session arguably could be the best yet. He spent the entire session collecting incredible data. Some of this I had never seen before. That's what makes him so great. We send him these questions, and if he doesn't know it, he does the homework. But the whole thing was about how meditation has been, or there's this common proclamation that meditators need less sleep, and advanced meditators, no sleep is required. And so he came up with some really interesting data around it, and I thought it was just brilliant. I thought it was probably the best session yet that I've experienced. So that'll be, for those of you who are nightclub members, that'll be posted probably within a day or so. Check it out. So yeah, I think what Dr. Ed said, if I remember, Barry, was just, let's see what happens. I think if you do experience it again, I might recommend a more professional consultation with Dr. Ed and ways to actually work with REM sleep behavioral disorder. But one episode, I probably wouldn't be too freaked out. Yes, it does cause a little bit of interest, concern. I think it's premature. So hang with it, see what happens. You know where to turn. You've got Dr. Ed. You can always ping him behind the scenes and he'll help you out. And then there are ways that this can be managed, right? So come on if you have anything more to say or ask around that, but that's my intuition. I don't think it's going to fundamentally disrupt your lucid dreaming practice per se. That's my take. But let me know. Okay, from Joe, people are leaving my life through death and disease. Yeah. No kidding, huh, Joe? I find I am grasping at those relationships because I have less and less long-term relationships and connections. We all do. We all grasp. I feel more alone in this world as a result. You're not alone in feeling alone. So if that makes you feel any better, you're not alone in feeling alone. Probably normal as a result of aging. Yes. Yes, unfortunately. Yes, just part of the life contract. It includes impermanence and the end of life, right? I mean, patronizing, but we forget. Is it grasping? And if so, any advice on practice for this grasping? I think this is a situation many of us will face. Yes, for sure. If we are lucky enough, fortunate enough to live long enough to face it. Is it grasping? Yes, it is grasping. Any advice for practicing on this? Well, first thing is give yourself a break. Let yourself some slack. Be kind to yourself. Metta, Maitri. You know, I do this thing. I do this every morning. This is like my favorite new thing. I riff on this. Every practice, every retreat I do now, I start every retreat in public when I do this. I start every morning with this. It's just the most wonderful thing. I just kind of developed it on my own. Some of the mudras anyway. The practice itself is a kind of a variation of metta or Maitri. We just put your hand over your heart in the morning. It's a nice thing. We can do it all right now. It's really a beautiful practice. Close your eyes and put your hand over your heart. And simply feel whatever you're feeling completely. Whatever it is, if you're feeling the loss of someone, something, doesn't matter. It literally does not matter. That's what makes it so powerful. Whatever you're feeling, feel it fully. This is like, for those of you who know the term, it's like Dzogchen feeling great completion. Feel it completely. And so when you feel this loneliness, this inevitable consequence of aging, just realize it's okay. Be kind to yourself. Realize this is a normal part of life and your reaction is completely normal. I find this practice alone, metta, you can conjoin it with a liturgy if you want, for sure, the four immeasurables, etc. But even without that, just this gesture of checking in, holding, almost like, hey, what's it like today? I'm okay. Whatever's happening, I'm okay. Give yourself permission to be human, radical acceptance. And then you can put your hand down if you had it up. And then in addition to that is just, you know, understand first that it's completely normal to grasp. As long as you have a sense of self and an ego, which we all do until we attain Buddhahood, we're going to grasp. Because that's what ego is. Ego is grasping. And so as we age and start to fall apart and things start to slip through like grains of sand, it's completely natural to grasp more and more and more because things are becoming more Bardo-like, more groundless. So advice is on practice there is just continue with whatever spiritual practice you're doing, practices of releasing. I'm not sure what meditation you do. Bardo yoga is specifically designed for this. Open awareness is specifically designed for this. Other more kind of generic practices will also help. I mean, every time you release your relationship, grasping to a thought. I mean, fundamentally, I can't say every single meditation, but so many meditations are really learning about letting go, releasing. It's not easy. That's why the painful bardo of dying is called painful. It hurts to let go. And so as we age, there's going to be more and more grasping and also some, you know, bitterness, some anger, some fear, because these are reconstituting, reifying emotions. And so the challenge is old age, sickness, and death. This is just part of the human contract. And the more we can accept it, the more we can establish a relationship to it, relate to it instead of from it, continue with our practices of just releasing, opening, the more we can have a graceful exit. So I label a lot of my programs on the Bardo's graceful exit. Well, what makes it graceful is the ability to let go. Easier said than done. That's why it's a practice. Ungraceful exit is raging, grasping, thrashing, you know, just not being able to slide into the transitional processes. So something like that, Joe. Okay, a couple longer ones from Eric. Hi, Andrew. I've been running into a bit of an obstacle with some of my lucids. That's an interesting term. I guess you mean lucid dreams. And although I understand that obstacles are the path, yes, if you relate to them properly, they are. Some guidance is appreciated. Okay, let's see if I can give you some. Basically, in many of my lucids, last night, for example, after several minutes, I entered a black void between dream scenes. Cool, good for you. Let's see what this black void's about. Essentially, the dream images manifestations fade. Yes, they do, like everything else. Everything fades, dream images as well. Back to you. Over the years, I noticed that I'm able to sustain awareness better during these states. Good for you. Possibly due to meditation practice. Yes, for sure. Definitely due to meditation practice. So high five to you. But I'm not always successful. Well, join the nocturnal club, right? This is also par for the course. Back to you. I've tried some methods suggested by Stephen LaBerge and others, rubbing hands, engaging tactile senses, yes, spinning and everything. Good for you. But these methods are hit or miss as well. Yeah, that's also really common. So everything you're saying is really, really common. But I think your essence here is the following. I was hoping you could elaborate more on the causes of these void states. Eastern or Western causes, simply neurological question. And possibly ways to continue through or preferably circumvent altogether. Okay, why do you want to circumvent them? Why do you perceive them as problematic? There's one of the most important things, and then I can give you some conjectures about causes, is just like with the earlier question, is just this curious acceptance of whatever arises. So why do you perceive this to be problematic would be one of my questions. In terms of the causes, boy, you know, I'd have to ask you some questions. That just because there's a black void, what's not clear to me is there a perceiver of the void? In other words, are you, when you're in that space, is there a sense of I'm perceiving the black void? Well, that's one instance. That's different from you becoming the black void. I'll say more about that in a second. So if there's an experience of I'm perceiving the black void, that is no different than perceiving the gap between your thoughts. It's the same thing. And so therefore, you can witness this as a type of Bardo experience, a gap between two phenomenal risings, in this case, dream scenes. And so that would still be dream yoga. That's not sleep yoga because it's still dualistic. It's not a criticism. It's just a way to understand you're having basically an experience of contentless dream within the context of dream yoga. Now, if you're having the experience, and again, it's not clear from what you share, I kind of suspect you're not because you may have said something. If you're having a non-dualistic relationship to the black void, in other words, when you're in it, you actually don't perceive anything. You only come out of it retrospectively and say, retrospectively, I experienced that void, but there was actually no you experiencing it. The black void was experiencing itself. Then that's high-level yoga nidra or sleep yoga. So I can't tell from what you're saying. The causes, one cause from an Eastern perspective is your mind slowing down and you're noticing the gaps between the phenomenal rising of your dream scenes, just like the gaps between your thoughts. And simply neurological? Sure, of course, you can't rule that out. So these, Eric, these questions are really hard to answer. Like, what exactly is it? Where is it coming from? Holy moly. I'd have to ask you a ton of questions. And even then, I'd probably just be guessing. But I think perhaps the most important thing is, what is the nature of this black void? Why do you want to get rid of it? What is your affective or emotional relationship to it? I mean, so it's a good question, but based on the material I have here, probably the best thing I can say. P.S. I had a non-lucid dream last night in which you were giving a talk and flying a spacecraft. Okay, cool. Usually when I enter people's dreams, it turns into a nightmare. So I'm glad you had a dream that wasn't a nightmare. Okay, I'm being goofy because it's the end of the day. Okay, another. Let me get a short one and then I'll get a longer one here from Carrie. This is an easy one. Hi, Andrew. Thoroughly enjoyed Ryan Hurd's Lucid Talisman Book Club. Yeah, so we brought my dear friend Ryan on board when I was traveling in Europe for a month. I love this guy. And he took my place for the Thursday book study group and went through the Lucid Talisman book. I agree. He's a rock star. And hope he can come back to teach again. Yeah, we were talking about it in the future. Yes, that's in the works. Would you consider inviting Sean Esperin Hargens and Andor Fariba Bagzaran to teach a course, short course for nightclub? No. And let me tell you why. I think it's a great idea. But these people there, especially Sean, I know Sean really well. We're in a book study group. We hang out all the time. I really love both these individuals, but they are so busy. They are unbelievably busy. So that's just not going to happen, I don't think, unless they approach me and say, hey, I really want to do a course for a nightclub. So I wouldn't hold your breath on that. Bringing Ryan back, for sure. Hang tight. He's got another book on sleep paralysis that we could definitely do. And I'm sure he's got something else up his sleeve as well. So I'm glad that course worked for you. Okay, a longer one again from Michelle. Hi, Andrew. I'm going to read this somewhat quickly to get to the quick. My question relates to the capacity to lucid dream and do things like state checks versus cultivating the capacity to be aware of awareness at all times, waking nocturnal states prep for dying. Okay. So this is, I'm going to run comment as I go through it. This is fundamentally the difference between what's called pellucidity or witnessing lucid dreams, where it's just like you say, you're simply just watching the dream. You're lucid, completely aware it's a lucid dream, but you're just witnessing it. You're not doing it. That's still dream yoga. It's just witnessing dream yoga. You're just not engaging it. Okay, the focus of my long-term practice within Vajrayana Dzogchen continues to be to have more clarity awareness. Absolutely. It's only game in town. A question related to lucid dreaming. I am often aware I am dreaming, have a reasonable recall, wonderful. My sleep is light, that's also nice. Awareness is present throughout the night and on waking up, but I don't seem to be able to go to that next step of entering the dream more fully when recognizing I'm dreaming. Okay, yeah, so in other words, you're not, from what it sounds like, you're not actually able or practiced, to engage the dream content and transform it. I mean, that's fine. Let me go through the question and see if you actually want to do that. Because that's basically stage 2 through 7 of my classic dream yoga stages. So back to you. Not always, but I am in an awareness. You're not in an awareness, you're in awareness. Oh, I see. But I am in an awareness observer space rather than identifying with the content, if that makes sense. Yes, it does make sense. First of all, if you were fully identifying with the content, that's the definition of a non-lucid dream. So there's some partial disidentification, differentiation taking place. Otherwise, you wouldn't be lucid at all. But I get what you're saying. I do experience feeling and move to tears at times. I'll talk to myself and remind myself I must remember this bit when I'm awake, and I do. So I'm present, but when I hear your guests and other lucid dreamers talk about their level of interaction within the dream, I'm wondering about my experience. Perhaps it's my training where over and over again, the instruction is to let go of trying to change anything and merely know, remaining open. For sure, like 100%, 100%, that's where it's coming from. And that's great. In the early days of my spiritual life, 3 decades ago, I was very visual and had psychic sensitivity. Cool. Awareness practice seems to have lessened rather than increased these capacities. Yeah, I'm not sure why that would be. I can't answer why that might be. Listening to you, I'm now getting a bit suspicious about my dream experience and wondering how I might brighten and bring more clarity. Okay. Yeah, well, this is a nice question. To brighten and bring more clarity, well, when you're having a dream and you're having a stable dream and a bright dream and a clear dream, where is that stability, clarity, and brightness coming from? There's no pre-existing dreamscape that somehow you have to turn on the lights or up whatever when you're in it. No. What are dreams made of? They're made of your mind. So you want to increase the brightness and clarity is increase the brightness and clarity of your mind. And there are so many ways to do this, but hey, here's a moment of shameless self-promotion. This is exactly what we're going to be doing in the Luminous Bardo Dharma Ta program, where we're going to be working, hence luminous, that has to do with the light of the mind. So bright and clear is luminous clarities. So outside of doing like Bardo yoga, studying luminous clarity and that capacity in the Luminous Bardo Dharma Ta, again, I don't know what practices you're doing here, but if you're doing Vajrayana Dzogchen, you've probably done some Yidam or deity yoga. You want to up that. That's what you want to do. The exercise is the same luminous muscle, so to speak. And so you will find that the more you do that, the more you do daytime visualization practice, Yidam practices, the more stable that gets, the more clear that gets, the more bright, more stable that gets. Well, guess what? Your dreams get more bright and clear. And so the other thing you can do, and I think I shared this with you guys, maybe, I don't know when, some time ago, I got into this jag a couple of years ago, exactly on this kind of thing. I was really interested in things like the light of the mind and how much light I could bring to my dream. And so I started doing this thing. I do this stuff all the time, like constantly. I'm always experimenting. I'm always playing with stuff. And so I got this bug up my dream butt, where I'm just going to take whatever image arises in the dream. And I remember it very clearly. It happened to be an orange. Now that's a cool image, right? So I had this orange in the dream. I became lucid and I remembered, I said, I want to explore this luminous light thing in my dream. And so what I did really, it was actually quite hysterical. Kind of like Men Who Stare at Goats. Is that what it's called? That hysterical movie with Clooney. That's a really fun movie, by the way. You know, what I did was, okay, you know, here I am in the dream, right? And so I'm looking at this orange, and again, of course, I'm not looking at the orange. It just appears that way. There's no me looking at the orange. The orange is looking at itself, but that's a different story. So imagine I'm still, you know, okay, I'm in the dream. And what I did was something like the following. You had to go, and I tried to just beam as much light or make the orange as luminous as I possibly could. It was actually quite hysterical. And so every time I did this one, I was amping. I went from a 110 to a 220. And I was just inserting more light of the mind into the orange. It was actually pretty bloody cool. I did this enough where it actually kind of turned into the light of the great Eastern sun. So Shambhala people might get a little riff out of this. I turned this orange. I got it so bright and so hot, it morphed into the great Eastern sun. For Shambhala people out there, that's a pretty cool exercise. So you can do this. If you don't do visualization and you're listening here going, I don't know what this deity yidam practice is. Shit, I don't know. Well, what you can do is, I don't have an orange here, but you can visualize. visualize anything, right? Just for the heck of it. Oh, look at there. My good friend has an orange. Thanks, Jan. Jan was also at Bayo. We had fun. Visualize an orange. You know, you don't have to do a deity thing. You can do it with eyes closed, eyes open. Take an orange. Usually at first it's better with or easier with eyes closed. Take an orange. Or if you like apple because of apple of the eye, close your eyes and try to visualize that apple or orange as clearly as you possibly can. Make it vibrant, make it resonant, and feel into it. Don't just visualize it cognitively. Get a kind of a somatic sense, so to speak. If you just do that, doesn't it quite the same power as a full-blown deity yoga or yin-on practice? But it's no small thing. You can sit there and just take that orange or apple, visualize it, use it. It's a form of shamatha. It's actually Vajrayana shamatha practice. Shamatha is stability, where you can use a candle, a breath, a body, a mantra. You can also use a visualization. And in the tantric world, that's tantric shamatha, where you take a visual object, bring it into your mind's eye, make it as clear, vibrant as you possibly can. That will definitely help. Okay. All right, two more and then we can open it up. From Ben, thanks for your stuff. Okay, thank you for saying those nice words. I'm a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner in the UK and had the following questions about the bardo becoming. Okay. Question. How frequently do your lucid dreams have to be in order for you to realize you're dead in the bardo becoming? Yeah, boy, I wish there was a number, right? Like you, Ben, for you, 20 times and you're good to go. I mean, there's no criteria like that. What the tradition says, Padmasambhava, for instance, the great Siddha who brought Buddhism from India to Tibet, and others have said, if you can maintain lucidity 7 times, you're going to be good in the bardo. Well, is this a real number or is it an archetypal number? Gyatso Rinpoche and Al Wallace in the translation of the teachings where I first read this say, this is an archetypal number. Don't take it literally. What it means is some level of constancy. What does that mean? Heck, I don't know. I just think it means some level of regularity. But here's the really good news here, Ben. This is really good news. It's also good news, bad news. But the good news for us is whatever takes place in the bardo, according to a number of tantra's teachings, and again, this number is also archetypal, is 7 to 9 times more efficacious, more transformative than it is in this waking life. And what that means, therefore, is you don't need to have a glimpse before it can transform into a gaze in the bardo. In other words, things can be very powerfully, positively amplified. And this makes a lot of sense to me because you're no longer restricted. The finitude of the body that limits awareness, that limits the infinite mind, that's being released. And so the light of awareness itself becomes much more heightened. And so this is actually really, really good news for all spiritual practitioners, for people who do these practices, that you do not have to be a raging virtuoso to have tremendous success in the bardos. You just have to have some level of constancy and faith in this doctrine. So how frequently? I don't know. I mean, really, nobody can answer that question. Just some level of constancy. What does that mean? I don't know. Presume is my favorite answer, by the way. My favorite answer, I love it. What Dafri John calls divine ignorance. I just feel, it makes me feel so light and free. I don't know. You know, the open questions. This is a lovely thing to say. Sometimes that's the best answer, by the way. Okay, back to you. Presumably, the more frequent the lucid dreams, the better. True. But is there a level of frequency, not that I'm aware of, that produces a reasonable likelihood that you realize you're dead in the bardo? There is no number outside of the 7, but that's an archetypal number. Relatedly, if you've been frequently having lucid dreams for a few years, perhaps because of the illness. Oh, yeah, that parenthetical interjection makes no sense to me, so I'll skip it. If you have been frequently having lucid dreams for years, but you weren't lucid for a significant period before your death, does that make it less likely that you will realize you're in the bardo becoming? No, not necessarily. Not necessarily. You know, the whole dream bardo business, because it's a much more open dimension. It isn't constricted and dictated by the laws of logic and rationality and physics and space and time. That's why there's so many weird things that can happen in the dream state and in the Bardo, which is just a dream at the end of time. These domains of mind don't play by the same rules as waking reality. And so we bring and impose the highlight, our limitations and say, it has to be this way in the Bardo because it's this way in the daytime state. No, the Bardos and the dreams are much more open. And so possibilities are heightened. There are actually more empty dimensions of reality. And the emptier, more open they are, the more possibilities there are. So we cannot bring the same metrics and criteria that we use for success or lack thereof in the waking state to the dream or to the Bardo dimension. It doesn't play by the same rules. That's one reason why people get frustrated with it. It doesn't do it like this. And why does it just completely disappear for whatever? Isn't it supposed to be like in this linear vector? No. I mean, you're basically romancing your mind. You're romancing dimensions of reality that just don't play by the Aristotelian worldview. So somewhere in there, Ben, maybe that's of some benefit. Okay, last one from Eric, my good bud, Eric, and then we'll open it up. Hey, Andrew, I've been meaning to say thanks for the talk you gave. This is Charlie Morley, my dear friend, asked me to do a riff a couple of weeks ago. He's doing a really cool training. And so I came in and subbed for a guy and we had fun. I was hoping you might be able to answer a question for today. Okay. How would you or someone who is able to maintain awareness throughout all the stages of sleep describe the phenomenological experience of light sleep? Yeah, non-REM sleep stage 2. Okay. I can align an experience with hypnagogia. Yes, non-REM 1. Okay, fair enough. REM and deep sleep. Paren, and would be curious to hear your thoughts on each of those as well. Oh, you're asking a lot here, bud. But I'm having a hard time putting my finger on what the experience of light sleep would be. Okay. Well, I mean, again, I can only tell you what it's like for me, right? And I've never done a phenomenological report in the dream lab when I've got a high density EEG cap that says, okay, you've now gone from beta to alpha to theta to delta, right? I've never been able to have that opportunity. So I can't tell you with complete authority that when I'm in what I think is light sleep, I'm actually in non-REM 2 or whatever. So a little bit shooting it from the hip here. But basically, you know, one of the things that constitutes light sleep for me is part of my dream brain. Part of my brain is awake. Part of my brain is asleep. This is one of the things we talked about with Dr. Ebb. That's actually quite important. It's not this big isomorphic unit that when you fall asleep, you wake or whatever. It's like the whole block. It's like a block universe. It's block consciousness through each stage. No. With increased measurements, neuroscientists are discovering what the wisdom traditions have actually been saying for thousands of years, that there are absolute granularities and gradations, that part of your brain can be awake, part of your brain can be asleep. And in the non-dual Shaiva Tantra tradition, I stumbled across, actually I didn't stumble across it. A friend of mine, scholar, sent me this text and I loved it. And I shared it with a bunch of neuroscientists and they go, shit, man, this is amazing. This is great. So they take the three main states of consciousness, waking, dreaming, and dreamless sleep, and they do the following. They go the waking of waking, the dreaming of waking, the sleeping of waking, the dreaming of dreaming, the waking of dreaming, the sleeping of dreaming, the sleeping of sleeping, the dreaming of sleeping, the awake of sleeping. And so what they do then is they have a more granular 9-stage description, which is much more accurate, and high-density EEG measurements are now confirming it. So for me, that's a little bit of the science. I like to blind people with science. For me, that's a little bit of what light sleep is like for me. I'm popping in and out. Definitely sensory awareness. The outward bound capacity of the mind is diminishing. It's not fully internalized yet because I'm still in light sleep. And so this is where you start to have this really interesting transformation of consciousness, where you go from thought to image, the thought image amalgamation to micro dreams to dreams. And so light sleep for me constitutes this kind of plasma of mind. And by definition, at least in my experience, it's inarticulate. It's just kind of all over the bloody place. So I'm not sure that's terribly helpful for you, Eric. I mean, the best thing you could do is you know, find somebody who can put you with a high, fit you with a high density EEG, and then just play with this stuff. Aura Ring, I don't think has enough resolution. So I'm not being terribly helpful with you here, but the other, I'm trying to think where else you could find some data here. I can't remember for sure, but if you don't have it already, you should have this anyway. You're a scholar, a kind guy. You know, one of my favorite books of the last 10 years in this business, Evan Thompson's Waking, Dreaming, Being, Self-Unconsciousness and Neuroscience, Meditation, and Philosophy. This book is a masterpiece. And he goes through the whole 24-hour cycle and how it is that self-unconsciousness go online, come offline, and all these different dimensions. And the cool thing is he brings a heck of a lot of research, scholarship, and science into it. I just can't remember with how much specificity he goes into this light sleep thing. So I wish I could be more helpful, my friend. That's kind of what comes to mind. Okay, here we go. So if anybody is here that I ran a comment on and want to follow up, more than welcome. Otherwise, I will start to go through the column. And if somebody wants to raise their hand and ask her, it doesn't have to be a question. You can share something. Okay. From Dwight, Andrew, please review the dreamless luminosity practice. Yikes. Geez, Dwight. That's a big question, man. Yeah, that's luminosity yoga. I mean, that's yoga nidra, right? So that's a massive topic, man. Well, there's a diurnal and a nocturnal component. The principal practice is the diurnal, the daytime practice of luminosity, which is working with formless dimensions, formless practices, open awareness, Mahamudra, Dzogchen. So when you're talking about dreamless luminosity practice, you're talking about graduate school, nocturnal meditation. I mean, this is not easy because it's so formless, it's so subtle. And so therefore the daytime component is massive because like Kabir said, of dream, of death applies to dream. What is found now is found then, or what is not found now is not found then. So if you have no relationship to the formless, egoless, selfless dimensions of your awareness during the day, you're not going to recognize it at night. So number one practice is the diurnal daytime practice, open awareness, Mahamudra, Dzogchen. The dreamless luminosity practices at night, honestly, I'm getting more and more appreciation for classic yoga nidra. Once you get past the phase where it's just this 51, 61 point relaxation thing, I'm not dissing it. But once you take yoga nidra into the deeper dimensions, it's virtually synonymous. And I've changed my tune on this because I just didn't know better. It's virtually synonymous with luminosity yoga. So I would recommend, I'm reading the book right now, Yoga Nidra, The Art of Transformative Sleep by Kamini Desai. She talks about this quite nicely. In terms of references, you know, I have a chapter in my book, Dream Yoga, about luminosity practice. But, you know, in terms of the night, just briefly, because again, this is such a big question, Dwight. You visualize a blue lotus in your heart center, not red, blue, with the four petals, with the seed syllables, and then you kind of step your way down. The other thing you can do that I've had actually more luck with is you use dream yoga as a halfway house. So you attain lucidity in the dream state, and then using that as a platform, you actually try to plunge into, the dreamless dimension. And you can do this a number of ways. One is just close your dream eyes, a little bit like the earlier question. It'll either just wake you up, because when you close your dream eyes, it tends to stop the cessation of your physical eye. That stops the REM, rapid eye movement, characteristic of sleep. You wake up. So on one level, that can just bust you right out of a dream. And then you've gone the wrong direction, right? Instead of going down, you go up. Second thing that happened is, like with the previous question, you just see black, but you're still perceiving the black. That's still not dream yoga. It's just a blank, formless experience of the dream. That's not sleep yoga. And then the last one that works for me is close your eyes, hold your dream breath, and plunge through the floor of whatever dream experience you're in with the intention of arriving in your heart. Outside of that, the rest of it gets a little bit technical. The visualizations and stuff, I think, are above our pay grade for now, but maybe that is of some benefit. Okay, from Tim, this work with Dream Yoga is making me more aware of the mind created nature of all experience, including waking. High five. That's it. So do you think working with a path of Raja Yoga in the Hindu yoga tradition would be a great adjunct combination with Tibetan Dream Yoga? Yeah, why not? Sure. I mean, why not? I think any of the Hindu yogas, you know, Kriya, Raja, Bhakti, Gnana, Jnana, absolutely, all of them can help. So, I mean, anything that works with awareness, anything that works with cultivating openness is going to help. And so if you have some resonance with any of these yogas from the Hindu tradition, let's put it this way, it's not going to hurt. Okay. All right. So, hey, it looks like we have a nothing coming in live. So unless somebody pipes in something else, we could be done. I'll pause for a minute to see if somebody's just about to express themselves with a question. Hey, there's Kenneth. Kenneth, hey, man. He was also at Bale. This is so fun. Oh, my gosh. And there's Marilyn. Oh, my gosh. This is so great. So these are all, let me see, these are all wonderful people that were with us at Bale. I had fun. I'm not sure how much they did, but I thought it was great. This place is so beautiful. Cool. Oh, nice to see you guys. Excellente. All right. So, okay, we got, it's like an auction, right? Oh, one question was just piped in. From Jason, what is your opinion on imagery rehearsal therapy? Do you think those imagery rehearsal techniques should be more accessible for more people? I can't speak with any authority about this as a therapy. I think as a rehearsal strategy altogether, absolutely valuable. So I can't speak about the therapy end of it, Jason. I can speak about it as a pure rehearsal end. And in that capacity, it really is, in the way I have practiced with it, the way I've worked with it, it really is connected deeply to what I was talking about earlier about working with images in terms of heightening the power of the imagistic quality of the mind. That's certainly very helpful. That in itself is helpful in relation to the nocturnal world. The rehearsal capacity also, you know, you can do this. Arthur Rubinstein, I know I'm not answering your question directly because I'm not qualified to talk about the image of rehearsal therapy. Rubinstein had such amazing powers of visualization and imagination that he allegedly could conjure up in his imagination. And I actually did this a little bit when I was a kid as well. Didn't even know about it. He could conjure up a keyboard, a dream keyboard, not a dream keyboard, an imaginary keyboard in his mind, and rehearse a composition completely within the context of his imagination, and then perform it without ever touching a piano. I completely believe it, totally, 100%, because what you do with your mind changes your brain exactly the same way that what you do with the physical world changes your brain. So I can speak a little bit about that. The rest of it, I'm afraid I can't. Okay. Oh, Myra comes in a buzzer shot. Hey, speaking of buzzer shots, my team, the Denver Nuggets, Kenneth and I lost this. World champions, right? Pretty cool. I'm sure most of you like, I could care less. Actually, I never watched a basketball game, period. But when your hometown gets to the finals, you know, I watched a couple games and I have to say it was pretty cool. I mean, these athletes are amazing. I mean, they're all like, they're 6 feet, 8, 10, 7 feet tall, and they're dancing around like that on the floor. Are you kidding me? Okay, Myra, fire away, and then maybe we'll be done. My dear friend, Myra.
Yes. It caught me by surprise when you mentioned the deep nidra today and you recommended a book because I've been listening to you for so many years. I know. And, nidra has been always part of my practice. It's what I do sometimes when I wake up at 3 a.m. and I immediately go into dreams.
Cool.
So what was the transformation? What triggered your evolution?
In terms of my new relationship, I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
I'm
with the yoga nidra itself and the way that you say that, how it's related to it.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, part of it is I started reading more academic papers because, you know, the yoga nidra is a multivalent practice, right? This is what I'm discovering. And I'm sure this is probably old hat for you, but every single yoga nidra technique that I've ever experienced, and I've experienced a number, they never really say much and they never really get past the 61 point or whatever point relaxation thing. I mean, it's great, fantastic, wonderful, but it's like, okay, well, that's nice. But, you know, where's the nature of mind here? Where's luminosity yoga? Where's the nature of reality? Not once have I heard it. And so I just simply started being a little bit more curious when I dug deeper into it. And then I picked this book up because I wanted to get a little bit more about the history of yoga nidra. And then I realized that on one level, it really is this when it's taken to fruition, it is this kind of multivalent practice that can take you all the way from the initial liminal phase, all the way deep into the complete formless dimensions of your mind. And that's kind of cool. So it was basically just, you know, I'm always learning, I'm always studying, I'm always reading, and I'm having blind spots pointed out, and I continue to grow and learn. So my evolution is about being willing to say, crap, I just didn't know better, right? It's that simple. So if you have another book that you might recommend or something in your own experience that ties your experience of yoga nidra into classic Tibetan luminosity yoga, I'm all ears. You can share it with us now or you can ping me.
Well, no, for me, it became the reverse. Once I began to listen to you, I began to associate some of those luminous parts in a way that yoga nidra is like, looking back at some of your teachings, I realized that from the beginning, you may be saying things that I understood, but then it's like marinating. You keep listening and listening, get deeper, and it permeates your body in a different way.
Yeah, that's nice.
And in that sense, one day you realize, wow, that sensation that I have when I completely lost sense of where I was and I came back when the teacher began to say again, it's in that liminal state. Yeah. It's in that. So it gives the opportunity to open through relaxation the body in a way that you are out of your head and you can feel more.
Lovely. Spot on. So you've been doing this for a long time, right? Yeah. Good for you.
But I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, I was like, I began to, the other day I was remembering one of the first questions that I asked you was, and I mentioned, no, I want to know what one, you know, I'm trying to work in one taste, not knowing absolutely the extent of what that said, but I just realized that teachers lead you and point out at you things from the beginning, and it takes a while to you to feel it.
That's
and
sometimes spot on, well said.
Yeah, but thank you. I was curious.
Yeah, more than welcome. Susan Late, my Aristotle scholar friend in the chat, defining yoga nidra, paper by Swami Veda Bharati. Yes, I read that paper. That's a good one. Gives four stages. Yes, that's the paper that my friend Michelle Lowe. So she's I interviewed her on Nightclub Exclusive. It's not an Edge of Mind. She's really big into this, and so she was the one that started sending me this stuff after I had my conversation with her, and that started to shape shift. And then I just started doing my own little adventurous research. Blah blah blah. So hey, wow, we're actually going to come in under the hour mark. That's great. Excellent. Okay, right. It's like an auction. Going once, going twice. Sold. The session is over. So nice to see everybody again. If it means anything to you, always remember we're not just doing this for ourselves. If what we're doing can't be of benefit to others, it's irrelevant. So take whatever we do here, gather it in whatever way speaks to you, send it out as a kind of dedication of merit to all sentient beings. So otherwise we can just get too caught up in our own silly little whatevers and lose contact with what's really important. But yeah, you know, the usual daily. Next week, meditation thing on Monday. I can't remember if it's Joe or Jeffrey. I honestly don't remember. But we've got the usual offerings coming up and you will see me around the hood, so to speak. So thank you everybody for showing up. Let me see if anything else came in. No, I think we are good. Wonderful. Much love to you all. Sleep and dream beautifully. Ciao, ciao.